Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Pacific Island countries are being urged to look at debt and infrastructure offerings from China as long-term investments. China's courting them up to sign the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road Plan, aimed at connecting economies, promoting development, and improving relations between China and maritime countries. Sally Round has this report.
一带一路 with the Silk Road Economic Belt and the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road.
I still don't understand.
They're in a row thousands of years ago. Until somewhere
Online music videos are among China's promotional tools for the network of roads, railways, ports and cables, which are part of its Grand Belt and Road Initiative. Chinese President Xi Jinping announced the plan 5 years ago to connect 4 billion people in 65 countries across three continents. Belt and Road expert Professor Wang Yiwei has been in Fiji to explain China's thinking.
Firstly, the benefit is local. They lift the poverty, deal with the climate change, they need infrastructure building, they need electricity, need all this, everything. And the most important, need the mutual connectivity. If the single country, very small market, but mutual connected, they are big market. It's like European Union.
Professor Wang told scholars and students at the University of the South Pacific the plan is based on the win-win principle, everyone benefiting, including the Chinese companies involved. He says they're thinking long-term, helping to lift countries out of poverty and to create a new middle class.
So everything according to the local needs, negotiate with the government and then also talk with the NGO and the other companies according to the international standards.
Fijian economist Nilesh Gounder says Fiji has already signed up to the Pacific prong of the Silk Road strategy. He says new roads and bridges already being built by China are included in the plan, which will bring opportunities but also challenges for Pacific nations.
At the moment, it's not very clear what type of funding is available for Pacific Island countries under this initiative, whether it's grants, concessional loans, whether it's a combination of grants and concessional, and whether it is concessional loans, will it be less concessional than the Pacific's other main sources of loans? We already know countries such as Tonga, Samoa and Vanuatu have ongoing challenges regarding debt repayments.
Sri Lanka's Hambantota port is often cited as an example of what can go wrong with the Belt and Road Initiative. China has a 99-year lease on the port as debt relief. Nilesh Gounder says that raises questions for several Pacific countries already in debt to China.
The basic question remains, how will foreign investment be secured? Because we have seen previously, for example, in Sri Lanka, the debt-equity swap and the possibility of that remains anywhere in the world.
Professor Wang dismisses fears that Chinese-built infrastructure projects are tying countries into debt.
You borrow chicken from China. It's not ask you to cook this chicken and the soup and then consume it, and then you own the debts to China. We ask you that give chicken to you, it's like the chicken have the eggs, and then eggs have more chicken, and the chicken have more eggs. And in the future, the eggs pay back the debts, no problem.
The academic suggests a change in thinking is necessary.
China, we always think about the long term. I think that those countries, the South Pacific and others, also should think about the long term, because the infrastructure is for the long term economic growth and employing the give them more jobs for them.
Professor Wang dismisses concerns that military objectives or a hunt for access to resources are behind the Belt and Road Initiative.
Let me be clear again. Firstly, the Belt and Road Initiative is economic cooperation. Second, the projects is in the other countries. It's not Chinese projects. What kind of use for them? It depends on the local government, their need, their purpose. China is very efficient in building the projects, and we have technology, technicians, and money.
But Nilesh Gounder says concerns remain around environmental impacts and the use of foreign labour for Belt and Road projects. To this, Professor Wang responds that projects would all be tailored to local needs and done according to international standards. This is Sally Round.
Electoral officials in Solomon Islands are reminding voters and intending candidates to several penalties that now exist under the country's new electoral law. Four major offences like bribery, fraudulent voting, and penalties, including a 15-year prison sentence or fines of over $20,000, as well as automatic 5-year ban from voting or standing in Solomon Island elections. Lesser offenses like providing misleading information can still land offenders in jail for 5 years and see them paying fines up to $6,000. The chief electoral officer, Moses Santella, spoke to Corey Hawkins about the aspects of the new law.
Yes, I think one of the big changes to the national elections is that a candidate contesting election now, election must be a registered voter before it was done. That is a change that will come into effect in this election. I think the other significant change that have happened is that the penalties, the punishment for violating provisions are quite severe, unprecedented in terms of the level of penalties that can now be imposed on voters as well as also candidates. So it's like, for example, election bribery now is 150,000. Or 15 years imprisonment, or both. So this is a very severe penalty, the highest in this new electoral act. There is also another provision where if you are found guilty of this offense, and on top of that, you are barred from standing as a candidate or being a voter for 5 years. That means you'll miss 2 general elections. So that's also the comparison in terms of the new changes in terms of the penalty level that we are having now in the new act.
And is that all in effect for this election upcoming?
Yes. They all in effect. So there are 3 offences, the big ones: undue influence and also fraudulent voting. Those are the big ones where, and of course, election bribery. If you are convicted in court on these 3, you are definitely going to receive a 5-year ban from being a voter and also as a candidate to contest election.
And you think this is a positive move? You think it will help clean up some of the murky waters around elections in Solomon Islands?
And we have to see how voters respond to this. I think right now the trend is that still a lot of people do not really fully understand these new penalties. So this is what I am vigorously doing now by way of going out to the media, explaining to people about this. Be careful about misleading information. Misleading information is an offense, 50,000 or 5 years imprisonment. In other words, if you are bringing by way of filling up this form for transfer and you are lying about it, you are actually bringing in misleading information, and therefore you are very liable to commit an offence under this this particular offence relating to providing misleading information.
And you're about to go and sign an agreement with police for support for this process and going up into the elections. What's that going to be about?
Yes. We are having a joint operation. As you know, this is the first time. We are having, for quite some time now, of having general elections without Ramsey. So we are really joining force with the Royal Solomon Police Force in terms of their support in provisions of security to particular hotspots around the country. We are already in the process of identifying those, and we therefore need the Royal Solomon Police Force to work with us closely. To be able to have a good, peaceful, and fair election by March 2019.
Pacific Islands have been on both ends of the stick at the latest session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, which began last week. That includes criticism of one of the new members to the council, Australia, and efforts by another country vying for a seat on the body, that's Fiji, to defend its own human rights record. Johnny Blades has more.
Fiji's parliamentary opposition has urged the UN Human Rights Commission to conduct an audit of the rights situation in the country before considering Fiji's bid for a seat on the council. The opposition leader Roa Tumumu Kepa says that since abrogating the constitution in 2009, Fiji's government has established rule through draconian decrees that take control of people's lives, making a mockery of human rights there. On the other side of the world, in Geneva, representatives of Fiji's government mounted a defence of its human rights record. Penina Tuivanua Yelewa from Fiji's permanent mission to the UN told a working group meeting on arbitrary detention and involuntary disappearances that the rights of those detained by authorities were safeguarded.
With the assistance of Fiji's Legal Aid Commission, we have taken a further step in rolling out the first hour procedure, which guarantees every detained person access to competent, independent legal advice on the nature of detention, the reasons for detention, their rights while detained, and the avenues available should these rights be violated.
Ms. Tuivanua Yalewa said this was an important step in guaranteeing that detainees were not tortured or subject to other degrading treatment. In the past year, several allegations of torture have been mounted against the authorities in Fiji. Meanwhile, the treatment of West Papuans by Indonesian police and security forces remains of deep concern to Vanuatu's government. Speaking to the meeting, Noah Kulbach from Vanuatu's permanent mission to the UN raised concern about the arbitrary detention of Papuans, in particular those speaking out about their claim to self-determination.
Vanuatu condemned Indonesia's continued practice of arbitrary arrest and detention of indigenous Papuans, exercising their internationally protected rights to freedom of expression and assembly. Vanuatu notes with concern the raised by the working group on Indonesia's failure to respond to its request for a visit. So we call on Indonesia to allow UN a special mechanism to be able to address on and report on the systemic ongoing problem.
Indonesia denies that police routinely abuse human rights and has recently invited the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to send a team to visit Papua region. Meanwhile, the new UN Human Rights Chief is the former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet. During her speech at the session, she expressed concern about Australia's policy of offshore processing of asylum seekers. Ms. Bachelet said the processing centres on Nauru and Manus and the separation and detaining of families were an affront to protection of human rights.
Such policies offer no long-term solutions to anyone, only more hostility, misery, suffering and chaos. It is in the interest of every state to adopt migration policies that are grounded in reality, not in panic, which provide opportunities for safe, regular movement instead of forcing people to take lethal risk.
The UN High Commissioner has urged Australia to adopt a new global compact which provides for regional and international cooperation to establish prompt, humane reception for all people arriving at international borders. However, Australia has suggested it may withdraw from the compact following the United States, which not only refused to sign, but withdrew from the council itself in June. This is Johnny Blades.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A dramatic night rescue in difficult sea conditions off the Bougainville Atolls has highlighted the need for maritime safety improvements. Last Sunday, a 42-foot Bougainville-based yacht called the Magdalut managed to save the lives of eight people, including two young children, as their banana boat sank in heavy seas 25 nautical miles off the Nisan Island. The boat had suffered engine problems and was floundering in 4 to 5 meter seas with breaking white tops when the Magdalut discovered it. The owner of the yacht, Andrew Kilvert, told Koro Vakatula about the rescue.
They managed to get their engine going and come alongside. So the skipper stopped the boat, which is very difficult and very dangerous to do in those sort of sea conditions because the boat turns to the side and just starts rocking wildly. So as the boat rocked towards the 23-foot banana boat, they were able to throw the two young children up onto the deck. And you've got to remember, this is all done in pitch black, with like spray and white water breaking over everyone and people's eyes. You know what salt does, that sort of wind and spray, you can't see anything. what they did then was they said, well, look, it's going to be impossible to load everyone like this, so we'll break the way and you just keep running your engine and just follow in our wake. Anyway, after about an hour or so, what happened then was their engine just conked out completely. And the seas were getting progressively worse as well. So what happened then was we've got it's like a 25mm woven rope that floats on the back of our boat. They then kept the torch on that boat, and then they came around underneath and deployed their safety line. So the six remaining passengers on the boat were then told to like try and get to the safety line. And as this process was going on, their boat was getting swamped and then it sank. And so we had six people in the water in the pitch dark. Luckily, we had two police on board and a person who chartered the boat who were absolutely up to the task of working with my crew. The passengers had to make it to the rescue line. My skipper and my navigator, they hauled in six people. And look, you know what it's like when you haul in a big fish. You imagine hauling in a rope that's got six people in heavy seas.
So it could have been a real tragedy, well, as you say, the conditions, but also the location. You mentioned that it wasn't too far to being swept out to sea.
Where they were, with the wind and the tide carrying them east, they were lost. They were dead. This was absolutely a million to one chance. We just happened to intercept their course. When our boats get swept east, they're lost. When they get swept west, they get swept down the side of the New Britain Islands. But when they go east, they're dead.
Those conditions, how come the banana boat was out there?
The banana boat was out there because it had engine problems. We've got a strait which is 42 nautical miles of open ocean. And it's a dangerous strait, and it was Gipper who didn't have a lot of experience, and big seas down to the east, there's really strong winds down to the east of the Solomon Islands that are picking up a big swell. So even though it might feel like light winds when you're in sheltered waters, when you go out, you're dealing with a big swell.
This is not the first rescue that your vessel's been involved in. Is there a need for maybe more kind of, I don't know, maritime safety awareness, that sort of thing?
There's an absolute need for maritime safety awareness. I've, along with a bunch of Nissan Islanders, put together a maritime safety report. On small craft, we need radios. And because I understand how culture works on the island, I've set up a system where it's actually not too hard to manage. You check out, you pick up your handheld radio. With my own money, I've set up a system of VHF radios throughout our Nissan Pinnipel Islands, which gives us a coverage of about 500 square nautical miles. So all we need is handheld VHF radios, which means that when boats get into trouble, they're actually able to contact it. The other problem that's happened to us as well is that our telephone system doesn't work on the island. So a banana boat can be missing for a week before anyone realises that it's missing. So these are the really basic issues.
A scheme allowing Vanuatu women to set up food stalls near Nakamals and Kava clubs is making an impression on patrons. Nakamal is one of the places where Nivatula tradition comes together to consume kava, a root-based brew which brings the fundamental role into Vanuatu society. Being able to tap into the space has helped women and their families financially. Morara Tupa Taylor was in Vanuatu recently and filed this report.
Asanet Nase lives in the freshwater area in the capital port Vila and is part of the 20 Vatu business scheme. 20 Vatu is about 40 New Zealand cents. Most evenings, Asanet and her friends sell home-cooked food to the patrons of the kava clubs. She says the money helps with school fees, food, electricity, and they can make decent money.
1,000 more, like 5,000, yeah, out of this three or two or four, they can earn more, up to 5,000 fatu.
She says most of the business ladies are mothers, and once children are sent to school, the women start preparing for their food stores.
Every day they have to go and pay the food in the market, local market, or the meats in the supermarkets, and they come and prepare it at home.
Asanet Nase also says a lot of the 20 Vatu women will buy fresh produce from other women at the market.
Plant their own crops from the garden and they sell the green, like bananas and taros in the market. And like us women from freshwater area, we went to the market and bought the baskets of the products where the mothers from the villages there and come and prepare for the 25th.
She says the scheme helps women become financially independent so they don't rely on their men as often.
25th business is a normal business for the ladies in this area, freshwater area, to support them with their families at home.
Vanuatu's former ambassador to the European Union, Roy Mickey Joy, says the 25th scheme is a fantastic idea.
Beautiful food. And they sell those for those who, you know, those who come, they need something to bite on. But that also contributes significantly to their little income and putting bread on the butter and in the table, helping school fees and making day-to-day ends meet.
He says kava continues to play an important role in Vanuatu society.
First of all, it brings people and families together, you know, convention and gathering. And then secondly, kava has also been highly commercialized. So in this family year, the only source of income is by selling kava every afternoon. And the profit they make will be able to assist in putting bread and butter on the table.
Eddie Dick is a nakamal owner in Port Vila and says he gets about 5 or 10 people a day and every week maybe about 50 to 60. He says kava should not be drunk on its own.
You can't drink kava by yourself. You have to drink kava with friends because when we drink kava we story anything that any issue which is stay in our community or between us. We share the problem, yes.
He says the profits made from the nakamau can go towards different things.
We are building a house, and sometimes we put, when all the profit comes, we keep it aside. Small go to school fee, small go to our food every day. Small profit, but we use it wisely.
Eddie Dick says he believes the best kava in Vanuatu comes from the island of Pentecost, and that's where he buys it from. Whichever island it comes from, kava is a commodity very close to the hearts of all Ni Vanuatu, according to Roy Mickey Joy.
In fact, for us, kava is what is known as a green gold. We believe in the next few years, with proper regulation, proper administration of kava, Vanuatu will be able to be the only country in the Pacific with the highest export the potential on kava overseas. Yeah.
He welcomed the lifting of sanctions against kava products in the European market a few years ago. Since then, Vanuatu's kava industry has increasingly urged farmers to focus on growing the noble variety, which is considered the best quality kava, both for export and for local consumption. When the nakamal is thriving, everyone benefits.
Staying in Vanuatu, the new chief executive officer of Vanuatu's Broadcasting and Television Corporation says he's winning back the public trust in the state broadcaster. Actually, has been a bit of a challenge. Last year, the Vanuatu government appointed a new board and a task force to urgently reform the state broadcaster. Francis Herman has been at the top job now for about 8 months and told MTT about what the first long list of things to do was.
Remove the regulatory functions from the National Broadcasting Service. And that was successfully done a couple of months ago when Parliament passed the bill to transfer the regulatory functions to the telecom regulator. So it means that VBTC is no longer a player and referee, we're now just a player. So it makes it fair for everyone. Secondly, I think we were what we call hemorrhaging big time, bleeding profusely financially. So we've been working on a program to plug the leaks. And we think 7 months down the track, we've been able to plug the leaks. So we've stopped the boat from sinking right now. And what we're trying to do now is to refloat the boat and head it in a direction that will be able to service the people of Vanuatu a lot better. The third thing was to recruit appropriate staff. So we set ourselves out, because the previous government and the previous management and board made everyone redundant. And then after paying them all back, reemployed them on the same terms and conditions. So we're saying, that's not right. So we put everyone off and we advertise every position. So we're saying everyone must come through the front door. All the 48 staff we have on board now came in on merit. And of the 48 staff, 52% are women. And 63% of our total staff complement have never worked for VBTC before and are practically new to the industry. And the reason we did that was the only way to change the work culture was to change the people.
What do you think was one of the biggest challenges coming into this position?
Apart from the financials and the technical infrastructure, VBTC had lost touch with the people. We no longer had the hearts and the minds of the Vanuatus. We became irrelevant. And while government was pumping funds in, donor agencies were pumping funds into VBTC, we were not important to a lot of the people in Vanuatu because we had lost sight of our vision. So the biggest challenge for us, apart from the financials and infrastructure, was to win back the hearts and minds of the people, and that's what we're doing.
Challenges also, do you think, with trying to get coverage across all the many parts of Vanuatu?
Yeah, we have the shortwave, the medium wave, and the FM for radio. And the shortwave is only working during the daytime. We lose people after 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So the medium wave is only heard in Port Vila, which we should have shut down and just run the FM. It's cheaper because same coverage area. And all the islands, 70% of the population couldn't even hear us. They listen to New Zealand, they listen to Australia, they listen to Fiji, and they listen to the Solomon Islands. But they couldn't hear their own station, so we became irrelevant. We were known as Radio Kolta, Kolta being bitumen. So we could only be heard where there was bitumen roads. And it's sad. When our people feel that way. And television could only be heard in the two capital cities. It could be seen only in Port Vila and in Luganville. So 80-90% of the country couldn't even receive the national television service. That's changed. We're on the platform, satellite platform now, so we can be picked up everywhere in the islands, provided they have a set-top box. We've opened up a television service in Tana, Ishangil in Tana, which accounts for about 6,000 people. We're going to expand that into White Sands soon. We've opened up in Malekula. We're opening up in Big Bay in Santo. So television now covers a little bit more. And as we get more money, we will expand that service.
And I guess also a couple of years ago, PAM obviously hit some of the infrastructure. How are you coping with that too?
You know, PAM hit us almost more than 3 years ago. And VBTC has never repaired itself after PAM for some unknown reason. Yet there was a lot of funding available to the VBTC at the time. We've now put in applications for funding under the Cyclone PAM Rehabilitation Fund. Better late than never. Most of the funds been spent. But whatever little we can get, we'll try and restore the television and radio service.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. We'd love to hear from you and let us know, of course, where you heard the program, pcjmedia@gmail.com. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.